Chapter 3. The Cliffs Reel. The Aquilonian host was drawn up, long serried lines of pikemen and horsemen in gleaming steel, when a giant figure in black armor emerged from the royal pavilion, and as he swung up into the saddle of the black stallion held by four squires, a roar that shook the mountains went up from the host. They shook their blades and thundered forth their acclaim of their warrior king. Knights in gold-chased armor, pikemen in mail coats and basinets, archers in their leather jerkins with their longbows in their left hand. The host on the opposite side of the valley was in motion, trotting down the long, gentle slope toward the river, their steel shone through the mists of the morning that swirled about their horses' feet. The Aquilonian host moved leisurely to meet them. The measured tramp of the armored horses made the ground tremble. Banners flung out long silken folds in the morning wind. Lances swayed like a bristling forest, dipped and sank, their pennons fluttering about them. 10 men-at-arms, grim, taciturn veterans who could hold their tongues, guarded the royal pavilion. One squire stood in the tent, peering out through a slit in the doorway. But for the handful in the secret, no one else in the vast host knew that it was not Conan who rode on the great stallion at the head of the army. The Aquilonian host had assumed the customary formation. The strongest part was the center, composed entirely of heavily armored knights. The wings were made up of smaller bodies of horsemen, mounted men-at-arms mostly, supported by pikemen and archers. The latter were Bassonians from the western marches, strongly built men of medium stature in leathern jackets and iron headpieces. The Nemedian army came on in similar formation, and the two hosts moved toward the river, the wings in advance of the centers. In the center of the Aquilonian host, the great lion banner streamed its billowing black folds over the steel-clad figure on the black stallion. But on his dais in the royal pavilion, Conan groaned in anguish of spirit and cursed with strange heathen oaths. "The hosts move together," quoth the squire, watching from the door. "Hear the trumpets peal! Ha! The rising sun strikes fire from lance heads and helmets until I am dazzled. It turns the river crimson. Aye, it will be truly crimson before this day is done. The foe have reached the river. Now arrows fly between the hosts like stinging clouds that hide the sun. Ha! Well loosed, bowmen! The Bassonians have the better of it. Hark to them shout!" Faintly in the ears of the king, above the din of trumpets and clanging steel, came the deep, fierce shout of the Bassonians as they drew and loosed in perfect unison. "Their archers seek to hold ours in play while their knights ride into the river," said the squire. "The banks are not steep. They slope to the water's edge. The knights come on. They crash through the willows. By Mitra, the cloth-yard shafts find every crevice of their harness. Horses and men go down, struggling and thrashing in the water. It is not deep, nor is the current swift, but men are drowning there, dragged under by their armor and trampled by the frantic horses. Now the knights of Aquilonia advance. They ride into the water and engage the knights of Nemedia. The water swirls about their horses' bellies, and the clang of sword against sword is deafening."
"Crom!" burst in agony from Conan's lips. Life was coursing sluggishly back into his veins, but he still could not lift his mighty frame from the dais.
"The wings close in," said the squire. "Pikemen and swordmen fight hand to hand in the stream, and behind them the bowmen ply their shafts. By Mitra, the Nemedian arbalesters are sorely harried, and the Bassonians arch their arrows to drop amid the rear ranks. Their center gains not a foot, and their wings are pushed back up the stream again."
"Crom, Emir, and Mitra!" raged Conan. "Gods and devils, could I but reach the fighting, if just to die at the first blow!"
Outside, through the long hot day, the battle stormed and thundered. The valley shook to charge and countercharge, to the whistling of shafts and the crash of rending shields and splintering lances, but the hosts of Aquilonia held fast. Once they were forced back from the bank, but a countercharge with the black banner flowing over the black stallion regained the lost ground. And like an iron rampart, they held the right bank of the stream until at last the squire gave Conan the news that the Nemedians were falling back from the river.
"Their wings are in confusion," he cried. "Their knights reel back from the swordplay. But what is this? Your banner is in motion. The center sweeps into the stream. By Mitra, Valinus is leading the host across the river."
"Fool!" groaned Conan. "It may be a trick. He should hold his position. By dawn, Prospero will be here with the Poitanian levies."
"The knights ride into a hail of arrows," cried the squire. "But they do not falter. They sweep on. They have crossed. They charge up the slope. Palantides has hurled the wings across the river to their support. It is all he can do. The lion banner dips and staggers above the melee." The knights of Nemedia make a stand. They are broken. They fall back. Their left wing is in full flight, and our pikemen cut them down as they run. I see Valinus running and smiting like a madman. He is carried beyond himself by fighting lust. Men no longer look to Palantides. They follow Valinus, deeming him Conan as he rides with closed visor. But look, there is method in his madness. He swings wide of the Nemedian front with 5,000 knights, the pick of the army. The main host of the Nemedians is in confusion, and look, their flank is protected by cliffs, but there is a defile left unguarded. It is like a great cleft in the wall that opens behind the Nemedian lines. By Mitra, Valinus sees and seizes the opportunity. He has driven their wing before him, and he leads his knights toward that defile. They swing wide of the main battle. They cut through a line of spearmen. They charge into the defile.
"An ambush!"
cried Conan, striving to struggle upright.
"No,"
shouted the squire exultantly.
"The whole Nemedian host is in full sight. They have forgotten the defile. They never expected to be pushed back that far. Oh, fool, fool, Taraskus, to make such a blunder. Ah, I see lances and pennons pouring from the further mouth of the defile beyond the Nemedian lines. They will smite those ranks from the rear and crumple them. Mitra, what is this?"
He staggered as the walls of the tent swayed drunkenly. Afar over the thunder of the fight rose a deep bellowing roar, indescribably ominous.
"The cliffs reel!" shrieked the squire. "Ah, gods, what is this? The river foams out of its channel. The peaks are crumbling. The ground shakes, and the horses and riders in armor are overthrown. The cliffs are falling!"
With his words came a grinding rumble and a thunderous concussion, and the ground trembled. Over the roar of the battle sounded screams of mad terror.
"The cliffs have crumbled," cried the livid squire. "They have thundered down into the defile and crushed every living creature in it. I saw the lion banner wave an instant amid the dust and falling stones, and then it vanished. Ah, the Nemedians shout with triumph. Well may they shout, for the fall of the cliffs has wiped out 5,000 of our bravest knights. Hark!"
To Conan's ears came a vast torrent of sound, rising and rising in frenzy.
"The king is dead! The king is dead! Flee, flee! The king is dead!"
"Liars!" panted Conan. "Dogs! Knaves! Cowards! Oh, Crom, if I could but stand, but to crawl to the river with my sword in my teeth! How, boy, do they flee?"
"Aye!"
sobbed the squire.
"They spur for the river. They are broken, hurled on like spume before a storm. I see Palantides striving to stem the torrent. He is down, and the horses trample him. They rush into the river, knights, bowmen, pikemen, all mixed and mingled in one mad torrent of destruction. The Nemedians are on their heels, cutting them down like corn."
"But they will make a stand on this side of the river," cried the king.
With an effort that brought the sweat dripping from his temples, he heaved himself up on his elbows.
"Nay,"
cried the squire.
"They cannot. They are broken, routed. Oh, gods, that I should live to see this day."
Then he remembered his duty and shouted to the men-at-arms who stood stolidly watching the flight of their comrades.
"Get a horse, swiftly, and help me lift the king upon it. We dare not bide here."
But before they could do his bidding, the first drift of the storm was upon them. Knights and spearmen and archers fled among the tents, stumbling over ropes and baggage, and mingled with them were Nemedian riders who smote right and left at all alien figures. Tent ropes were cut, fires sprang up in a thousand places, and the plundering had already begun. The grim guardsmen about Conan's tent died where they stood, smiting and thrusting, and over their mangled corpses beat the hoofs of the conquerors. But the squire had drawn the flap close, and in the confused madness of the slaughter none realized that the pavilion held an occupant. So the flight and the pursuit swept past and roared away up the valley, and the squire looked out presently to see a cluster of men approaching the royal tent with evident purpose.
"Here comes the king of Nemedia with four companions and his squire," quoth he. "He will accept your surrender, my fair lord."
"Surrender to devil's heart," gritted the king.
He had forced himself to a sitting position. He swung his legs painfully off the dais and staggered upright, reeling drunkenly. The squire ran to assist him, but Conan pushed him away.
"Give me that bow," he gritted, indicating a longbow and quiver that hung from a tent pole.
"But your majesty,"
cried the squire in great perturbation,
"the battle is lost. It were the part of majesty to yield with the dignity becoming one of royal blood."
"I have no royal blood," ground Conan. "I am a barbarian and the son of a blacksmith."
Wrenching away the bow and an arrow, he staggered toward the opening of the pavilion. So formidable was his appearance, naked but for short leather breeks and sleeveless shirt, open to reveal a great hairy chest with his huge limbs and blue eyes blazing under his tangled black mane, that the squire shrank back, more afraid of his king than of the whole Nemedian host. Reeling on wide-braced legs, Conan drunkenly tore the door flap open and staggered out under the canopy. The king of Nemedia and his companions had dismounted, and they halted short, staring in wonder at the apparition confronting them.
"Here I am, you jackals!" roared the Cimmerian. "I am the king! Death to you, dog brothers!"
He jerked the arrow to its head and loosed, and the shaft feathered itself in the breast of the knight who stood beside Taraskus. Conan hurled the bow at the king of Nemedia.
"Curse my shaky hand! Come in and take me if you dare!"
Reeling backward on unsteady legs, he fell with his shoulders against a tent pole, and propped upright, he lifted his great sword with both hands.
"By Mitra, it is the king," swore Taraskus.
He cast a swift look about him and laughed.
"That other was a jackal in his harness. In, dogs, and take his head."
The three soldiers, men-at-arms bearing the emblem of the royal guards, rushed at the king, and one felled the squire with a blow of his mace. The other two fared less well. As the first rushed in, lifting his sword, Conan met him with a sweeping stroke that severed mail links like cloth and sheared the Nemedian's arm and shoulder clean from his body. His corpse, pitching backward, fell across his companion's legs. The man stumbled, and before he could recover, the great sword was through him. Conan wrenched out his steel with a racking gasp and staggered back against the tent pole. His great limbs trembled, his chest heaved, and sweat poured down his face and neck. But his eyes flamed with exultant savagery, and he panted,
"Why do you stand far off, dog of Belarus? I can't reach you. Come in and die."
Taraskus hesitated, glanced at the remaining man-at-arms and his squire, a gaunt, saturnine man in black mail, and took a step forward. He was far inferior in size and strength to the giant Cimmerian, but he was in full armor and was famed in all the western nations as a swordsman. But his squire caught his arm.
"Nay, your majesty, do not throw away your life. I will summon archers to shoot this barbarian as we shoot lions."
Neither of them had noticed that a chariot had approached while the fight was going on, and now it came to a halt before them. But Conan saw, looking over their shoulders, and a queer, chill sensation crawled along his spine. There was something vaguely unnatural about the appearance of the black horses that drew the vehicle, but it was the occupant of the chariot that arrested the king's attention. He was a tall man, superbly built, clad in a long, unadorned silk robe. He wore a shemitish headdress, and its lower folds hid his features except for the dark, magnetic eyes. The hands that grasped the reins, pulling the rearing horses back on their haunches, were white but strong. Conan glared at the stranger, all his primitive instincts aroused. He sensed an aura of menace and power that exuded from this veiled figure, a menace as definite as the windless waving of tall grass that marks the path of the serpent.
"Hail, Xaltotin!" exclaimed Taraskus. "Here is the king of Aquilonia. He did not die in the landslide, as we thought."
"I know," answered the other, without bothering to say how. "What is your present intention?"
"I will summon archers to slay him," answered the Nemedian. "As long as he lives, he will be dangerous to us."
"Yet even a dog has uses," answered Xaltotin. "Take him alive."
Conan laughed raspingly.
"Come and try," he challenged. "But for my treacherous legs, I'd hew you out of that chariot like a woodsman hewing a tree. But you'll never take me alive, damn you."
"He speaks the truth, I fear," said Taraskus.
"The man is a barbarian with the senseless ferocity of a wounded tiger. Let me summon the archers."
"Watch me and learn wisdom," advised Xaltotin.
His hand dipped into his robe and came out with something shining, a glistening sphere. This he threw suddenly at Conan. The Cimmerian contemptuously struck it aside with his sword, and at the instant of contact there was a sharp explosion, a flare of white blinding flame, and Conan pitched senseless to the ground.
"He is dead?"
Taraskus' tone was more assertion than inquiry.
"No, he is but senseless. He will recover his senses in a few hours. Bid your men bind his legs and arms and lift him into my chariot."
With a gesture, Taraskus did so, and they heaved the senseless king into the chariot, grunting at their burden. Xaltotin threw a velvet cloak over his body, completely covering him from any who might peer in. He gathered the reins in his hands.
"I'm for Belverus," he said. "Tell Amalric I will be with him if he needs me. But with Conan out of the way, with his army broken, lance and sword should suffice for the rest of the conquest. Prospero cannot be bringing more than 10,000 men to the field, and will doubtless fall back to Tarantia when he hears news of the battle. Say nothing to Amalric or Valerius or anyone about our capture. Let them think Conan died in the fall of the cliffs.
He looked at the man-at-arms for a long space until the guardsman moved restlessly, nervous under the scrutiny.
"What is that about your waist?" Zaltotin demanded.
"Why, my girdle, may it please you, my lord," stuttered the amazed guardsman.
"You lie."
Zaltotin's laugh was merciless as a sword-edge.
"It is a poisonous serpent. What a fool you are to wear a reptile about your waist."
With distended eyes, the man looked down, and to his utter horror, he saw the buckle of his girdle rear up at him. It was a snake's head. He saw the evil eyes and the dripping fangs, heard the hiss, and felt the loathsome contact of the thing about his body. He screamed hideously and struck at it with his naked hand, felt its fangs flesh themselves in that hand, and then he stiffened and fell heavily. Tarascus looked down at him without expression. He saw only the leathern girdle and the buckle, the pointed tongue of which was stuck in the guardsman's palm. Zaltotin turned his hypnotic gaze on Tarascus' squire, and the man turned ashen and began to tremble, but the king interposed.
"Nay, we can trust him."
The sorcerer tautened the reins and swung the horses round.
"See that this piece of work remains secret. If I am needed, let Alaro, Araste's servant, summon me as I have taught him. I will be in your palace at Belverus."
Tarascus lifted his hand in salutation, but his expression was not pleasant to see as he looked after the departing mesmerist.
"Why should he spare the Cimmerian?" whispered the frightened squire.
"That I am wondering myself," grunted Tarascus.
Behind the rumbling chariot, the dull roar of the battle and pursuit faded in the distance. The setting sun rimmed the cliffs with scarlet flame, and the chariot moved into the vast blue shadows floating up out of the east.